So welcome to the last lecture. So to start with, I would like to briefly recapitulate what we have learned yesterday. And basically, these two blackboards you have seen is all of symplectic geometry you need to know. So this is really simple stuff. So first, you define a symplectic manifold to be a pair of the manifold, which is now equipped with a special object. This object is by definition a two-form, so it's an antisymmetric, totally antisymmetric tensor of rank 0, 2. And you require that this two-form is non-degenerate, meaning that if you understand it as a matrix, it will have the full matrix rank. So in other words, basically no zero eigenvalues. And that it's closed, so d omega equals to 0. So that's the definition of a symplectic manifold. Once you have a symplectic manifold, you can define many objects using this two-form omega. So for example, the simplest object you can define is an inverse of omega. So now I define this capital omega. And it's defined by a matrix inverse. So this is precisely how would you say there's a matrix inverse. The only problem is that now we deal with antisymmetric matrices, so it's important over which index you contract, whether you multiply from left or whether you multiply from right. Things may depend on that. OK, so now I showed you that now having these two objects, you can actually sort of map vectors to covectors and vice versa. So it's not really important to distinguish the indices, the upper indices from lower indices in the presence of omega. The same thing happens when you have a metric, although the map is different. OK. So now, perhaps the central thing is that omega allows you to any function on this symplectic manifold, it allows you to define the corresponding vector field XF. So this is called Hamiltonian vector field. So sometimes people use this definition here. So they associate XF with a flow. So you know that each vector field defines the flow in that manifold. And so the parameter TF would be a parameter which goes along that flow. So sometimes people associate that, well, they define this as precisely, it's a definition of what you mean by this vector field, or definition of a notation that this is my parameter which goes along that flow, generated by that vector field. But the definition is that it's this capital omega times DF. So capital omega, so now this is a vector field in that symplectic manifold. And I've shown you yesterday that the definition is equivalent to this relation here. So now you can use this small omega, and again, it defines this XF. So now XF is a very nice field because from its definition, it follows that it preserves the symplectic structure. It preserves the symplectic two-form. And this stands behind the Liouville theorem as we've seen it. So that in particular, that the time evolution preserves the volume of the phase space. OK, so this is precisely that statement. So Hamiltonian vector fields are quite nice. So you can also define the Poisson bracket. And so definition was basically this one here. So to any two functions on the symplectic manifold, you define a new function, which is given here. So omega likes to eat forms. So it eats one form here, another form here. It produces a scalar. And so that's my new scalar function. You can equivalently write it in this form, where you use small omega. So now this is a two-form, so it likes to eat vectors. And it eats the corresponding vector field generated by F. And it eats the corresponding vector field generated by G. Okay, so this is precisely related in the same way as these two are related. So now, if you are looking at this relation here, of course, I can write this df, but omega dot dg is nothing else than xg. So I'm just using this definition here. So now, what this guy is, if you swap the order, this is a vector times form. So it's a scalar product between vector and form. And so if you write it in components, it's nothing else than x mu partial mu on acting on f. which is precisely how we define how the vector field acts on a function. Okay? So this is the corresponding vector field acting on a function, and it's precisely in components of S. And again, I define this, that this is a d of f, now with respect to the time evolution given by this function g. Okay, so it's precisely this definition here. Okay, so that's what it is. But of course, the Poisson bracket is defined because this guy is anti-symmetric, it's anti-symmetric. And if it's anti-symmetric, I can swap the two, I pick up a minus sign, and I can play the same game. So now I'll find that it's minus xf acting on g, or it's minus dg or on dtf. Okay? So it's just because of the anti-symmetry of this thing. So now if you look at this guy and that guy, so it's xf acting on g, and it's some differential operator d over dtf acting on g. So now if I pull out g, then I have an equality that xf is d over dtf. Well, that's my definition. I can do the same thing here. I can pull out g here, and then I see that it's dot, whatever is missing there, and f. Okay, so this is, in other words, the Poisson bracket where you don't put anything in one of the slots is a vector field. Okay, and so this is how it looks like. So finally, this was all coordinate independent and nice. So now we can choose special coordinates, which are called canonical or Darboux coordinates on M. And so this will be, because we have two n-dimensional manifold, I'll have n of these and n of those. I just denoted them by Q and P, but of course, it's just a notation. But the statement is that you can find such coordinates that this omega takes a very, very special form. It's basically everywhere zero, but close to the diagonal, it has plus one, minus one, and so on, in two-dimensional blocks. Okay, and so this is precisely this statement here. And it's related to the fact that omega is non-degenerate and it's closed. Okay, so now once we have this form here, then you can write down your explicit form in these coordinates for the vector field generated by f. So again, this is whatever the definition I had and whatever I showed here. But now you can actually write down how these Poisson brackets look precisely in terms of using this specific form of small omega or big omega. And then you find that it's given by this thing here. There's df over dpi, d over dqi. So remember, this is my basis of that vector. And these are my components of that vector. And the same here. So now the vector lives in that whole overall symplectic manifold. That's why it has some basis in the q direction, but it has also some basis in the p direction. And these are the corresponding components. Okay? So this is how that vector field looks like. And it's nothing else than if so this is x mu f. Now this is stupid notation. But anyway, so this is the vector, and this is my coordinate basis. Okay? So now, if you feed in the function g, well, of course, everywhere where you saw nothing, you just plug in g. So in this dot, you plug g, and in that dot, you plug g, and you see that you recover the standard canonical Poisson bracket as you know it from your undergraduate course. Okay? So this is all of symplectic geometry you need to know to understand Hamiltonian mechanics. Other questions? You see that everything is very, very compact and nice. So part B, let me now apply this to Hamiltonian mechanics. And so I'll start part one, the basic theory. So I've done the same thing for the Lagrangian mechanics, but maybe now if I do it again for Hamiltonian, which is exactly the same thing, it will repeat the thing. So maybe you will remember. So I didn't really define what a configuration space is. So configuration space C is really the space where which describes the photo of the system. So for a system with n degrees of freedom, and so you would like your motion to happen on that manifold. So basically, it's a motion on the manifold. And so the configuration space is the corresponding manifold. Okay. So is a manifold of dimension n, And so you can write down the local coordinates, which will be just QIs. Equipped with local coordinates QI. So really, the picture is I have the manifold. Now I want to describe some motion, so I want to describe how the system sweep trajectory from one point on the manifold to another point on the manifold. So this will be Q0, and then this will be later Q. And so the trajectory is the trajectory which I'll denote delta t. So as I move forward in time, I always have one point on that manifold. And so this is the trajectory which corresponds to time evolution. Okay? So at any given time, I'll have just one point on that on that manifold, which describes a photo of the system, how the system looks like at a given time. Okay, so this is where the motion happens. But of course, we know that it doesn't contain the whole information about the system, because to predict what's happening with the system, you need not only to know what the position is, but you also need to know the momenta. So that happens in the phase space. So phase space and you will define this so you know that the momenta are really one forms. So this must be a cotangent bundle over this configuration space. Cotangent bundle T star of C. Okay. So as a cotangent bundle, it has dimension 2n. So has dimension 2n. And the local coordinates are nothing else than with local coordinates, which are, of course, the positions q1, q2, qn, but also the momenta p1, p2, and pn. Okay, so this is how the cotangent bundle, how the phase space looks like. So now, what Alex said yesterday was completely right. I just was completely confused, but he's right. So once you know the dynamical system, of course, you better know these things. You better know these coordinates. And so once you know these coordinates, you can define some things. For example, you can define the symplectic structure omega. Okay, so the way how you do that is that you say, well, first, let's define so-called Cartan's form, Cartan's one form theta. So you know these coordinates here. So theta, so this is a one form, so it belongs to T star of T star of C. So this is my phase space, and this is a one-form space over that. Okay, and you define it simply by pi dqi. So it's a one-form where you take the exterior derivative of the coordinates qi, and then multiply them by the corresponding p. So p1 dq1 plus p2 dq2, and so on. Okay, and then you can define, so you know, having these, this you can do, and then you define omega to be d theta. Okay, and so this is just dpi wedge dqi. Okay, and so this is your natural symplectic structure for your phase space. So let me stress this shift. So in the previous, I talked about symplectic manifolds. And I told you, well, symplectic manifold is defined by having this symplectic two form. Now, what I'm telling you is that if you consider the phase space, which is a special two-n-dimensional space, two-n-dimensional manifold, equipped with these coordinates, then you always have the corresponding symplectic structure. So the phase space always admits a natural symplectic structure, omega. Okay. So now, obviously, by definition, if you look at this thing here, well, it will be closed because it's actually exact. And it will be non-degenerate as long as these pi and qi are independent coordinates. So if you have constraints, you are in trouble. But if you don't, then this is fine. And so this is really a symplectic structure. So now you define dynamics by specifying the Hamiltonian, by specifying Hamiltonian H, Hamiltonian H, which is a map from, it's a function on the phase space, so to R. And of course, it's a function of the coordinates, so qi and then pi. So now, typically, I was writing also a function of t. So you cannot do it with symplectic geometry. You would have to consider all-dimensional version of symplectic geometry. And I will mention this towards the end of the lecture today. So at this point, I'm limiting myself to the fact that there is no t dependence. So no explicit t dependence. And so such systems are called autonomous systems. Okay. But it's usually the case. So you know, we are not really losing much by saying this is the case. But yeah, you can do with time as well. And the description is slightly different. Well, basically the same, but I'll show you some differences. Okay. So because Hamiltonian is just a function on the phase space on your symplectic manifold, you can define the corresponding Hamiltonian vector field. So which in this case is called dynamical Hamiltonian vector field. So this defines dynamical Hamiltonian vector field. So I'll typically just say dynamical field, but I don't know what I will say, but okay. So this is nothing else than X H, okay, so by using the same logic, now I should assign that this is equal to d over dt, and then I should write h here, right, because it's the time generated by h, but is this simply something which is special and people don't write that h there, so they just write d over dt, but they say t is really the time generated by the Hamiltonian, okay? And so by definition, it's just omega dot dh. So it's precisely as we define Hamiltonian vector fields. And then you can also write it in terms of the Poisson bracket, as we have seen. So it's the Poisson bracket where I leave the first slot open, ready to eat something, and then I plug the other slot equal to h. Okay, so now this dynamical vector field, of course, defines the corresponding integral curves. So this field generates its integral curves. And so I will denote the corresponding curve in that phase space as gamma of t. And of course, it's just a set in our local coordinates. It will be just how q depends on t and how p depends on t. So that sweeps a curve in that phase space. Okay, so now look at this beautiful thing. So we can write down what we mean, that the field x is a tangent to these curves. So that means that xh, so remember, the tangent means that I have to be tangent to this curve. So it has the form q dot d over dq plus p dot d over dp. Right? So that's how you were writing tangent fields. So you were writing dx mu over dt, d over dx mu. Okay, so this is precisely what I'm writing here. So this is d over dt, but it's nothing else than dqi over dt, d over dqi, and then plus dpi over dt, d over dpi. Okay, so it's a vector field, so that this curve, which is described by this p of t and q of t, is tangent to it. Okay, so this is what tangent means. However, I have also this definition of what I mean by this vector field, and it's given by this symplectic form here, and it's given by a Hamiltonian. So at the same time, this must be equal to dot h. Okay, and so because my form, symplectic form, now takes the canonical form, I can use this relation here to see how that vector field looks like. So there's this thing here. So it'll be dh over dpi, and then d over dqi, and then minus dh over dqi, d over dpi. Okay, so that's, I'm using the canonical form of my Poisson bracket, if you want. Okay, is this clear? So now look at this beauty. So these are the two expressions for my vector field x. Now I can compare whatever I see in the first line with whatever I see in the second line. So if I'm comparing whatever stands by d over dqi, I'm comparing this with that. And so this must be, of course, equal. So I'm getting that dh over dpi is just qi dot. And I'm getting that this must be equal to that. So dh over dqi is minus pi dot. And maybe you know these equations. And so you see that the Hamilton's equations, they just follow from the fact that my dynamical vector field has some curves, indicates some curves to which it is tangent. And it's given as a vector field corresponding to the Hamiltonian H. OK, so these are the Hamilton's equations, of course. And they naturally fall out of this Hamilton's equations. Okay, so finally, as I was saying before, you are not really interested in... So by solving these equations, what you really find is this curve gamma. Okay, so they determine the curve gamma of t. In other words, how q of t looks like and how p of t looks like. And typically, people are not interested in how the momenta look like in time, but they are only interested in q of t. So in the end, you want to project down this thing to the curve on the manifold rather than the curve in the phase space. So finally, people interested in delta of t rather than gamma of t. And so this is given by a canonical projection. So delta of t is simply given by this canonical projection where you forget everything about the momenta and you just project everything down to the configuration space, and that's the solution. Okay, so is this clear? Does it make sense? So the typical example, again, is the one of the pendulum. So you can study the pendulum in the phase space. Then you have phi direction and the p phi direction. The vector field x will sweep some trajectories there. And so if you forget that p direction and project it to the phi direction, this will be your solution of phi of t, which is how it really sweeps here. Okay, so anyway, so this is how you solve dynamical problems. So finally, of course, let me mention that because this dynamical vector field is a Hamiltonian vector field, we automatically get that this is true. And so that's why the time evolution preserves the volume of the phase space. So we get the Liouville theorem here. Okay. So as the basic theory, we solve the problem. Of course, not really. It requires that we really can solve these Hamilton's equations. And the way to do it is through these canonical transformations. Transformations. So the statement is you now define such a transformation of the phase space coordinates Q and P and then PJ, function of Q and P. So again, I don't allow for time dependence. You would have to go beyond this. But yeah, for autonomous systems, you don't need that. And you say, so such transformation is canonical provided it preserves canonical form of omega. So in other words, in the old coordinates, I had this beautiful Darboux coordinates where I could write omega as dpi dqi, dpi hdqi. So now I'm allowed to change coordinates in such a way that in the new coordinates P and capital P and capital Q, it has exactly the same form, dpi wedge dqi. So such transformations of coordinates you will call canonical transformations. OK. So it's really that you are having a preferred form of omega, and then you require that the form of omega doesn't change under this change of coordinates. So let me do an example. For example, in one dimension, so this is what you require. So now we understand capital P as a function of small q and p, and capital Q as a function of small q and p. So I can write explicitly what these differentials are. So this is dp over dq dq plus dp over dp dp as the first term. And now dq is dq over dq dq plus dq over dp dp. Okay. So you just now write down explicitly these differentials in terms of the old coordinates. So now, okay, so I have to multiply these brackets through. Of course, whenever I see dq, wedge dq is equal to 0, and similar dp, wedge dp is equal to 0. So let's say this term contributes. So I'll have this is equal to dp over d small p dq over d small q, and then I have dp wedge dq. That's one of the terms which contributes, and then another term which contributes is this one. So it's plus dp over dq dq over dp dq wedge dp. Okay, so these are the only terms I'm getting. Of course, these guys are antisymmetric, so let's write them. So this is minus dp wedge dq. And so now if you stare at this thing here, you will see that this is nothing else than the Poisson bracket dp wedge dq. So you are immediately getting a condition which tells you, well, is my new coordinates really canonical coordinates? Well, this will be only true that it's equal to dp dq only if q and p is equal to 1, which is precisely that fundamental bracket which has to hold. And I told you it's one of the conditions for the transformation to be canonical. So basically, this gives you an equation that your new coordinates are canonical as it should. So far, everything is clear, or is excellent. So now you are making this change of coordinates, and so it may happen that in one coordinate, I have my form, which is Cartan's form, which is pi dqi. In the other coordinates, I have a different form, which is pi dqi. Okay. So now the only thing which I require is that d theta equals to omega, which is precisely the same omega as d of theta. So this is what you require so that your transformation is canonical, so that really we get the same thing. So we dpi dqi equals to d small qi d small pi. OK, so this is what you require. So in other words, if I subtract the two equations, so omega minus omega is 0. So 0 equals 2. Now d, so now which way I want to go? Theta minus theta tilde must be 0, because it's omega minus omega must be equal to 0. However, what this tells me is that, at least locally, this thing inside must be a total differential, must be an exterior differential. Okay, so in other words, this thing, it must be given by d of f. So because theta is a one form, f is a function. So at least locally, there exists a generating function f of q and p, such that you see that really the coordinates small p and q are related to coordinates big p and q. So by the way, I haven't stressed that, but I hope it's obvious that if I require that the form of omega doesn't change, so really if I require that this is true, then if you look at the derivation of the Hamilton's equations, of course I will get the same form of Hamilton's equations, right? So this is obvious that I will have the same thing, but now with capital P and capital Q, if I reset the form, because that was the only information I needed, right, to derive these equations. Okay, so now you have basically proved that, yeah, every canonical transformation is locally generated by a generating function f, which is nothing else than theta minus theta tilde is equal to df. Okay? So we are getting a formula that pi dqi minus pi dqi must be equal to df. That's your formula for the generating function. So now, of course, the function f is a function of small q and p. But it may happen that I can use my new coordinate q as a function of q and p. So this f is a function of q and p. But perhaps I can write it as a function of q and p. So locally, around some point, I introduce a new coordinate q, which is non-degenerate in that sense that this still is fine. Okay, so of course it may happen that I choose such a stupid q that it won't be non-degenerate, and this will be, for example, only function of q, and then I degenerated my thing and I cannot do it, right? So that's why for special cases this thing may not be true, but in general cases it will be. If I have that special case that this is, for example, only function of small q, then I need to choose a different function. So let's say I'll choose capital P here. Okay. So anyway, so let me assume this. So in other words, I'm choosing f. So in other words, I'm just writing f as a function of small q and capital Q, assuming that this is actually all well defined. So if this is true, then I just write down what this differential is. So then I have an equation pi dqi minus pi dqi. So now it's df over dqi dqi plus df over the capital qi dqi. Okay, so just writing what the differential is. And you see that p has to be, so you are getting that df over dqi is small pi. And then the other condition is that df over dqi is minus pi. And so these are precisely the conditions which you derived for the generating function previously. Okay, so generating function is really just a consequence of the fact that theta minus theta tilde is locally written as d of f. Okay, so now if you're looking at this, so by the way, we are never talking about the Hamiltonian here, and because we are preserving the form of omega, we are not changing the Hamiltonian. So in this case, the Hamiltonian h prime will be indeed equal to the original Hamiltonian h. So So that's the final thing which we derived before. So we are not touching the Hamiltonian in this prescription. You will be touching the Hamiltonian only if it is explicitly time dependent. And only in that case, actually, you will have plus df over dt term there. OK? So that's the canonical transformations. So you see, we struggled for almost one lecture with canonical transformations, and it can be done in three lines here. So that's the beauty of the formalism here. Oh, I need this one. So let me delete this one here. So we talked about the basic theory about how to derive the Hamilton's equations. We talked what the canonical transformations really are. So now let me talk about the symmetries. So part three, symmetries. And so without any hesitation, let me formulate new version of the Noether's theorem. So Noether's theorem. And I would say Hamiltonian version. So version 4 is just the Hamiltonian version. Of course, this is the most beautiful version, I would say. So now, what do you assume? So you have your phase space, okay? And so then you know that the Noether's theorem discusses the relation between the symmetries and the existence of integrals of motion, okay? So what we assume here is there is some symmetry on the phase space, okay? So now phase space, of course, admits the Hamiltonian. So this symmetry must be a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. But at the same time, we know that the phase space is equipped with the symplectic 2 form. So it must be also a symmetry of the symplectic 2 form in some sense. So let y be a vector field, which of course depends, well, which is a vector field on our phase space, such that it preserves both. It preserves the symplectic structure, and it preserves the Hamiltonian. So then you say it's a symmetry. OK, so we find such a vector field which leaves the Hamiltonian invariant and leaves the symplectic 2 form invariant. So then we better find an integral of motion, and indeed that's the statement. So then there exists a function I such that it's an integral of motion. So di over dt is equal to 0, which is in our case just so the lead derivative of I with respect to our dynamical vector field must be equal to 0. And so that's it. So that's the statement. So now I haven't really proved Noether's theorem, but it's, you know, it takes some time to prove it. So let's see how fast we prove this one here. Okay. So proof. Again, it will be a constructive proof. So it will actually tell you how to find this I. So we know, in the first step, we have to use the assumptions, right? So we know that this guy is equal to 0. OK. So let's use Cartan's lemma as always. So we have that this is y hook d omega plus d y hook omega. OK, so that's the Cartan's lemma. So now d omega, as always, is equal to 0 because omega is closed. So So now we have 0 equals to d of something. So in other words, whatever is in there must be d of something locally. And so typically, it's a minus sign. So this is d of some function I, at least locally. So locally, there must exist a function I so that y hook omega is minus di. And this is precisely how you construct this I. So there exists, in other words, there exists I such that it is given by y hook omega equals to minus di. Okay? So there exists some function so that this must be true.
When you say locally, you mean that around each point, you can have different functions around each point such that that happens, right?
So what I mean is, in the neighborhood of a point,
yeah, but I mean the function doesn't have to be the same around each point. So around some point, you have I. Around another point, you can have g. And still it will be equal to zero.
Okay. So I mean more than that. I mean basically, you know, if you have manifold with no holes, this will be globally true. So okay. So the only thing is the topological obstructions. So if you go around the hole, you may not come to the same thing. But in a neighborhood of any point, it will be true. And it's the same I. Okay, so we know there must be this function I, and this is the prescription how to find it. So now our second assumption is that the Hamiltonian is untouched by this vector field. So Ly on H is equal to 0. That's what you might mean by the symmetry of the dynamics. But we know that Y, if you look at this thing, is actually, so that means that Y is actually a Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to that function I, right? So this is precisely, if you look at over here, so it is a Hamiltonian function, so I must be, y must be generated by this Hamiltonian vector. It's a Hamiltonian. So this is Lyi of H. Okay. But now if you look at the formulas above, this is nothing else than the Poisson bracket of H and I. Okay? So now we use the antisymmetry of the Poisson bracket. So this is how typically Noether's theorem is stated, that HI equals to minus IH. In other words, the time evolution, well, okay, let me write it down. So this is true, so this is minus di over dt, and it's still 0. Okay? So this you say, we have a symmetry, so the flow generated by I leaves Hamiltonian untouched, but it equals to minus that, so the time evolution of I is untouched. Okay. Okay, and we are done. So this is a very, very constructive way, so if you can find the symmetry, so if you can find the vector field y, you know how to find the corresponding function I, and you know that this corresponding function actually is an integral of motion. So you see two lines to prove this beautiful theorem in this notation. Okay. So what I would like to stress here is that we never talked here about the symmetries of the configuration space of the underlying manifold. We talk about symmetries of the phase space. Y lives in the phase space. So this is on the level of phase space. So it is in some sense much more general than what's typically done in undergraduate courses, where you just talk about symmetries of the configuration space. So let me explain why this is more general. And it's, of course, the nature of
what this vector field y, how does it look like?
And the statement is that typically you have two kinds of symmetries. One of them is familiar, the other one is less familiar. So according to nature of phi, so you may be asking, you know, what happens if I do this canonical projection on y? Okay, so y is a symmetry of the phase space, and now you can project it down to the configuration space. Or rather, yeah, okay. So you do pi of y, and then you have two options. Either you get a vector field which lives on C. So in other words, if I project my vector field in the phase space down to the configuration space, I see some non-trivial, it's a non-trivial vector field which lives on the configuration space. So in other words, there is a symmetry of the configuration space. Vector field on C, or if you want, symmetry of C. Okay, and so symmetries like that are called isometries, and they are typically what happens. So such symmetries you precisely discuss when you discuss Noether's theorem on the configuration space. However, it may happen that after the projection of Y, you don't get anything sensible on the configuration space. So this projection is not well defined. On C. So in other words, after the projection, the vector field will still have some momenta in it and stuff like that. If you have still some momenta in it, of course, it's not a vector field on the configuration space. It still carries the information about the dynamics of the particle. And so that's why such symmetries are called dynamical. Or hidden symmetries. Okay, so this is very confusing. So really, the first type of symmetries, you look at the manifold, you see that the manifold is somehow symmetric. For example, I rotate it, and it looks the same. Or I move, you know, there's a translation invariance or whatever. So there is a symmetry on the manifold. And then there's a corresponding integral of motion, but it's an isometry. So the second type of the symmetry is much more subtle. You don't see any symmetry of the manifold. But after you put some particles on that manifold and you observe how they move, you suddenly see they move some nice way. They are not supposed to move. And so there must be an initial symmetry which is hiding in the phase space, which is not seen on the configuration space. OK, so an example of a hidden symmetry, well, we don't have to go very far. We can just study the familiar thing, which is the Kepler problem. So in other words, it's a motion in the central force, where the force is given by minus k, some constant, r square, and r hat. So it depends only. It's a spherical symmetric force, but of special type 1 over r square. OK, so this is a unit vector in here. So OK, so now, because the force is spherically symmetric, nothing depends on time, you typically have some conserved quantities corresponding to that. So you have spherical symmetry, and you have stationarity, basically. So then you have conserved energy and conserved angular momentum. OK? So we have isometries. So in other words, the symmetries which you can see, you know, just from the definition of the problem, which is stationarity. So nothing depends on time in your Hamiltonian. And you have also spherical symmetry. Uh,
And of course, the stationary theory implies the existence of the conserved energy. And spherical symmetry implies the existence of the conserved angular momentum.
Okay, so now this is nice, and everybody knows that. But your problem actually admits an additional integral of motion, which is not of this type, and is precisely of the hidden symmetry type, and that's called Runge-Lenz vector.
We also have a hidden symmetry. Given by so-called Runge.
Well, sometimes it's Laplace Runge-Lenz vector.
So there is an additional quantity which is conserved, and it's of this type. So it's denoted by A, it's a vector, and it's simply P times L minus mkr hat, where m is the mass of the particle. So there exists this conserved additional quantity. Of course, each component of that vector commutes, Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian. So it's a conserved quantity. But as you will show today in your tutorial, this is precisely a hidden symmetry. If you find the corresponding vector flow in the phase space and you project it down by this projection pi, you don't get anything which can be seen on the configuration space. It's a hidden symmetry. Okay, so now what is the meaning of this? Let me draw a picture. And of course, it's not obvious at all why this should work. If you've read Feynman's lectures on something, then he basically rediscovers the existence of this vector by some nice geometrical arguments. He's not the first one. Of course, people knew about this already in the 18th century. But I think his discovery is probably original in the sense that he didn't know about those results, and he just derived them again. But anyway, so it's precisely that vector he's talking about there. So there is some geometrical meaning to this thing, but it's completely, I don't know what it means. So if you think about the ellipse, so I have one focus, another focus here. And so you know that there's the sun here or whatever, and then the motion of the planet is around that. So now if I draw something like this, so this thing here will be mkr hat. Now this thing here is p times l. And you have to subtract the two things. So you are getting that vector A is actually this thing here. It's the line going, sorry, this is too small, going that way. So similarly, you could draw it, for example, here. So then you would have this, and this would be your vector A. Or you could draw it here, and this would be your vector A. And then this would be your vector A. So vector A, of course, it's constant of motion, so it has to point all the way the same direction. And so this is the meaning of that vector A, which is conserved. So now, so this, as I said, if you want, read Feynman's lecture on something, and he will rediscover the existence of this vector just by some nice geometric arguments for you. So now people are asking, what is the meaning of this A? And nobody really knows why it exists there. What is the meaning? How you can describe it? So there are, certain observations. For example, you can map the problem to the motion, to the geodesic motion in some high-dimensional space, and then this vector A sort of behaves like an angular momentum. But of course, that's a nice observation, which doesn't explain really anything. So nobody really knows why this vector A is there and why exactly for the Kepler problem. So if you consider just a spherically symmetric force, this thing will not be there. This is only there if you have precisely the force 1 over r squared. Okay?
so nobody knows.
So now let me just mention this thing here.
There are two relations which sort of restrict the number of independent things you have.
So you have a times l is equal to zero, and also a square equals to something which you already know. So m square k square plus 2m e l square.
Okay, lx square, ly square, lz square. So what it means is that if you take all the conserved quantities you have, then you have one of those, three of those, three of those. So it seems like you have seven, but there are two constraints. So we have actually seven minus two, which is five, independent and conserved quantities. So now, if you recall Liouville's theorem, how many do we need to have integrable system? So how many degrees of freedom this system has? So now considering a motion in the spherical symmetric potential, so it's 3 degrees of freedom, right? So I have three-dimensional space. So we have 3 degrees of freedom. How many degrees of freedom we need to have completely integrable system? Exactly the same number. So it's again three. So now you see that we have actually two more. Okay. In fact, so n is enough. So n equals to three is the number of degrees of freedom. So we need complete integrability requires precisely n. And independent integrals of motion, and then integrals of motion, so three. However, in this case, we have actually 2n minus 1 in Kepler. So five. What it means, so if you have more than n integrals of motion, your motion is called not only completely integrable, but you would say that completely superintegrable. And if you have maximum number of all of them, which is at most 2n minus 1, because the last one is always just the shift in time. So you can choose any origin of time. So this is called maximally superintegrable.
But they are all in evolution, and they are all independent.
Sorry, they are?
In evolution.
Ah, very good. So you can show, this is a very good question. So for integrability, you require that you have n of those which are independent and in involution. Okay. So now, if you think about the involution property, it's just a property that two integrals, their Poisson bracket equals to zero. Okay. So now you can show, and the Poisson bracket is given by this omega. Okay. So now you can show that the Poisson bracket, if you had more than n such solutions, if you had more than n functions, which would be in involution, the Poisson bracket would have to be degenerate. The omega would have to be degenerate. So, okay. So you may have at most n which are in involution functions, okay, so for any omega. Okay, so they are not in involution. They cannot be. Only three of them are. Okay, and you can choose whatever you want. So you can choose combinations of three, sets of three, which are in involution. But they are independent. So you have five independent, out of which three at most are in involution. Okay, so these are called maximally superintegrable systems. They are, of course, very, very, very rare. But interestingly, they happen in nature, and they describe things like the motion of the planets. Okay, questions? Yeah?
So what do you get from them being maximally superintegrable?
You get some even nicer properties than for integrable. So if you have integrable, you can actually integrate it. If you have superintegrable, you can do something more. So basically, but I don't know. So really, people use this maximal superintegrability to integrate these equations in a fancy way, right? So basically, in a fancy way. Moreover, well, I didn't want to mention this, but there is this extension of Hamiltonian mechanics where, you know, nobody tells you that it's enough to have one Hamiltonian which defines your dynamics and that every system will just behave in a way that it's enough to specify one function, which is the Hamiltonian which specifies the dynamics. So there is an extension of Hamiltonian mechanics saying, well, maybe you need two functions. Okay, maybe I need two functions to specify dynamics, or three functions, or arbitrary number of functions. Okay, so now this is called Nambu mechanics. And everything works very nicely at a theoretical level. Nobody discovered any system which would need two functions, two Hamiltonians, to describe it. But what is certainly true is that you can use these integrals of motion as more Hamiltonian. So if you have maximally superintegrable systems, actually, you can write them down in this Nambu formulation, where you take a number of them as your Hamiltonians. Okay, but of course, in this case, the description is enough in terms of one Hamiltonian, and you don't need these extra things. But at least it's an example that Nambu mechanics, there are systems which you can cast in the form of Nambu mechanics. Okay, so yeah, so. So, for example, so fancy ways you can use these extra integrals of motion, but in practice you don't really need them. Yeah. Okay, I have 5 minutes, so that's not enough. So what I would like to mention towards the end is that at this point I always specified two time independent things. So Hamiltonian was time independent. Function f was time independent, the generating function, and so on. So let me just make a few comments what happens when you have time dependence. And so it's enough if you just remember the name. So for if you have time dependent systems, then actually, the symplectic geometry is not good description. And you need to, and so this is what I would like you to remember, you need to use a different geometry, which is called contact geometry. Okay, so time-dependent systems are described by contact geometry. Contact geometry. And so first, people thought, well, this is really stupid and poor cousin of symplectic geometry. But now people think more and more that it's actually nicer than symplectic geometry. OK, so anyway, so by contact geometry, which is, in some sense, an odd dimensional version of symplectic geometry. And so why it is in some sense nicer is that, so it lives now, so the space, the manifold is now 2n plus 1 dimensional, where of course for applications to mechanics I want to have the phase space which is 2n dimensional, but also I want the time. So this is for time. So now you promote time to be another coordinate, and so you have 2n plus 1 dimensional phase space, well 2n plus 1 dimensional manifold. Okay, and so time is now included in this extra one plus one dimension. And so what is nice about this is that, okay, you can always forget about the time, and then you can return back to the symplectic geometry. Okay, so in that sense, it's nice. So now, otherwise, it's precisely the same. You again talk about omega. So contact geometry will again have omega, which is again closed. But instead of non-degenerate, it's non-singular. Okay, so play with words. But what it means is that, well, if you are in 2n plus 1 dimensions, if you are in all dimensions, any antisymmetric 2 form will always have at least one zero value eigenvalue. Okay, so your omega alpha beta, the best you can do is that, as before, you would have these diagonals where you would have minus 1, 1, and so on.
But in the end, you would have extra one where there would be zero. So let's say, okay, so I have another one here, zero minus one, one, and zero. But in this plus one dimension, I just get the zero here. So it is degenerate in the sense that you have no zero value eigenvalue. Okay? But otherwise, it's the same thing. Because it's degenerate, you cannot define capital omega, but you don't care. So what you now define is, again, the Cartan's form, which will be given by pi dqi minus hdt. So now you are plugging the Hamiltonian, and this is your extra direction in that phase, in that space. And omega is d of that. Okay, so this is what you do. So now we had this beautiful formula for the dynamical vector field, which was that it's just something which is generated by the Hamiltonian. Where is it? Doesn't matter. So we had that x acting on omega is basically minus dh. Okay. So now the dynamical field is even more simpler in that in its definition. You just define the dynamical field by this. Okay. So x is simply something which it's a null direction. It's a null direction of your omega. If you want, if you understand omega as a matrix, this has a zero value eigenvector of omega. It's the dynamical vector field. Okay. So that's the difference.
What do you mean by dynamical vector field is like what was the Hamiltonian vector field?
So this is XH.
So it's like the direction in time is associated to the zero.
Exactly. So this is precisely how XH looks like now. So now, of course, the canonical transformations are something which preserve the form of omega. So omega is now dpi dqi minus dh hdt. So this is omega, and now you require then the new one will be precisely the same thing, dqi minus h prime dt. Okay, so you find some new Hamiltonian h prime and new coordinates p and q, so that this is true. Okay, so that's what you say is a canonical transformation. And so, for example, the Hamilton-Jacobi theory tells you, well, this is really stupid to do. My omega is degenerate anyway. It has always this zero value eigenvalue here. And I don't need really that h to know about it because, so it has really the rank of omega is 2n, right? But of course, dpi hdqi is 2n already. So I don't need the last term. Why would I need the last term? So the statement is I am choosing h equal to zero. So the omega just looks like whatever you had in the symplectic case. But you have now this extra zero. And now if you are looking for the vector field of this thing here, then the vector field will just have a component in this extra t direction. So in general, the vector field is some complicated thing which sweeps q and p and t directions. But if you choose h prime equal to 0, then x is simply just t over dt. Okay. So in other words, what you are doing in the Hamilton-Jacobi theory is that if you have now your extended phase space, so you have t, p, and q, and you start somewhere, and then this is your curved lines as you go away. So from q0, p0, you go here, and so you change p in the time evolution, you change q in the time evolution, you change t. So this is your dynamical vector field everywhere. So now the Hamilton-Jacobi theory just tells you, well, this is really stupid to do. Let's just keep q's constant, p's constant. There is no time evolution. And so you are just moving in the t direction. So you are doing something like this, where your time evolution is only in t direction. And so you keep q0, p0 is the same thing as here, q0 and p0. And your vector field x is just moving in the t direction. And this is the meaning of Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Okay? You are just, you know, making it straight.
Okay, so that's the geometric meaning of Hamilton-Jacob theory. All right, so let me conclude. So I hope you enjoyed the course. The course basically wanted to show you several things. One of them is that the mechanics is described by this beautiful geometrical picture, by this symplectic geometry or contact geometry, if you want. And you know, using these things, everything becomes much more elegant and much more insightful. So you really understand what's going on when you say this is a canonical transformation. You just say, well, I preserve the form of omega. Or if you know, you understand what is the meaning of the Hamilton-Jacob equation, you're just straightening the lines in the phase space, and that's it. Okay. So now, on the way, of course, you had to learn the differential geometry, and that may be a painful way, and then, you know, painful thing to do. But of course, once you do that, it opens possibilities for you to study many more things. So you will see that differential geometry is not only useful for classical mechanics, but general relativity basis on differential geometry, as you will see in 2 weeks. So you will really need differential geometry for that. But also, somebody asked in the audience, you know, can I do Legendre transformations for thermodynamics in the similar way as I do for mechanics? Can I do the similar description for thermodynamics? The answer is yes. So basically, if you consider the first law, so dE is TdS minus PdV or whatever, and now you put dE on the right-hand side and compare with theta, this is a Cartan's form for thermodynamics. And you can start doing geometry of thermodynamics in the same way as you were doing geometry of classical mechanics. And there are lots of papers recently about how really people try to geometrize thermodynamics. And again, you are learning some new things. So thermodynamics also can be cast in this thing. Of course, when you discuss field theory and gauge theories in particular, you will learn that the gauge fields, as you know them, for example, the vector field A, is nothing else than a connection, differential connection for your covariant derivative and stuff like that. You can use this in string theory. You will discuss the Dirac equation. Dirac equation, you can do it in painful way in terms of the gamma matrices. Or you can do it, actually, you will learn that spinners are precisely represented by differential forms. So differential forms, basically, you may not need to work with gamma matrices. You can work with differential forms. And it's the same thing. So again, a very, very useful thing. So now what immediately evades you is the GR. And let me just stress that all of mechanics bases on omega, which is non-degenerate, anti-symmetric, and obeys d omega equals to 0. So now GR bases on metric, which is non-degenerate, now symmetric, and nabla g equals to 0, whatever that nabla is. OK, so you see that's exactly the same thing, basically. Well, thank you. And so we will see in tutorial applications to Kepler problem today. That's it. Questions? OK.